This is The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz. Artificial intelligence isn't replacing us, it's riding shotgun. Our next guest is journalist Eric Sullivan, who edited a feature story for Scientific American titled Living in the Copilot Society. This look at AI explores what happens when it becomes less of a tool and more of a partner, helping us write, diagnose, design, decide, even think.
So are we outsourcing judgment? Are we expanding human potential? Or quietly redefining what it means to be skilled, creative, and accountable? Eric Sullivan is the senior tech editor at Scientific American, and he joins us today to talk about the promises, the trade-offs, and the profound societal shifts that come with living alongside intelligent co-pilots. Eric, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
You say in the introduction to this collection of short articles in Scientific American this month that the harms will scale faster than the benefits. And we brought you on this show instead of our science and technology show to talk about this because it's in all of our lives every day. I woke up at 4:30 this morning and couldn't go back to sleep. So I used ChatGPT to help me redesign my mudroom, which is a chaotic mess right now. And I would say it's also providing entertainment. And it's not always right. So it's really affecting all of our lives. From your perspective, kind of editing these articles, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, as you mentioned, AI is not just a tool anymore. It has become this sort of background infrastructure in our lives. It's pretty amazing to think that it's only been 2.5 years since ChatGPT came out and really kind of kickstarted what we now know as this AI era that we are so firmly in. So I think that there has been a real fear, rightfully, that this is a human versus machine story. And at least as it's played out now, it really seems that it's a human plus machine story inside the imperfect institutions that we live in every day. I think that the degree to which it is both an amazing technology that is transforming all of our lives, as well as an overhyped claim of technological evolution that is going to make all of our lives better. I think all of this is true.
Yeah. I've wanted to talk to someone about the electricity usage, and you do sort of mention it, that an AI-focused data center can consume as much electricity as 100,000 homes. It's just going to grow exponentially from here, which is really one of the scariest elements of AI. And so when, for example, your average person is up early redesigning their mudroom and they go, oh, no, that's not right. Can you just remove a few more shelves and then give me that rendering? There's this little thing in my head that's saying, wow, a year, 2 years, 5 years from now, I won't believe that I was doing that because I'll know how much electricity that was consuming. Is this a thing that's relevant and now and is something that we think about?
It is a huge part of the larger AI story. The electricity and energy demands are astronomical and growing all the time. And the amount of money required to build the infrastructure that is both pulling that energy and also, you know, increasingly infrastructure that is producing that energy. But the reality is that not enough energy can be produced at the rate that AI is demanding. And so I think that it is certainly a question that we need to be mindful of, that I think that the question of where we go with the data centers becomes one of regulation, something that is in policyholders' hands. It's somewhat out of our hands. And so I think it's something that we definitely need to be mindful of, but I do not think that you need to be so concerned about the mudroom question and how much energy you're using. Yes, the chat bot uses on average something like 10 times as much energy as Google would use for a search. Do not quote me on that number. I could be using an old number. However, there are far worse energy sucks happening in the world than your search. And, you know, I bet the mudroom is going to look great because of it.
I don't know if you've ever been to Park City, but we have a lot of coats and boots and stuff like that here. It's very, very difficult to keep these mudrooms rolling. Well, let's talk about this on a little bit more of a personal level. Many of the people who are using or just starting to experiment with AI tools are not tech or business users. They're just people at home doing their life and trying to use it as a life hack tool. I have one friend who uploaded all her digital journals to AI and uses it for this tool for personal growth. And another one who loaded in all their bills and asset information, asking for financial strategies. Now, this to me sounds terrifying. That's a lot of personal information in the name of most effective guidance. What do you see as possible issues down the line with creating this kind of online database of your private life, if there's a problem with it at all, in your opinion?
Well, I would say that the issues of privacy are certainly not new. And the same degree of concern that you've taken with your personal information and that we've all learned to take ownership of in this digital age that we live in, you know, I think you just have to follow those same principles. In other words, do not put your social security number into ChatGPT. Do not put, your loved one's information to, if you're uploading photographs, don't necessarily put your face in it because your face will all of a sudden become part of its learning system. So you really do need to be careful with your own personal information. However, and I think that, it really comes down to the degree of trust you put in these institutions. And the reality is that you should really follow your heart on it, but at the end of the day, not share very much at all.
Yeah. And it seems like organizing my photos without faces in them might, not be the most effective use of my time or my questions. I'm very fearful right now of what might be happening in our world for a lot of reasons, but AI is a huge one. And in my most scared moments, I'm imagining that we are all like in the Matrix and we're just batteries for our overlords who have decided that instead of serving humanity, that they want to just be served and serve themselves and maintain their own survival. How realistic or ridiculous is that?
Well, I think that one of the most overhyped things that I hear all the time is AI is as smart as, or as close to as smart as humans are, or that that is even a near-term possibility. I admit that this is my own personal take, and you will get different answers depending on different tech folks that you speak to. I think that a lot of folks that work in this space are much more, they would say, hopeful. I would say wishfully optimistic that this is actually going to come to fruition, that AI will somehow achieve something close to human-like intelligence. And I think that the overhype there is both, worth acknowledging, but I think also rooted in very real concerns. You know, I think that there's also on the opposite side, the sense that AI can serve as a sort of autopilot where you can set it and forget it. When in fact, AI really does require at its best, like any, it's a tool that requires human involvement. The tool is only as good as the human who's using it and their familiarity with it and their ability to use it. So I think that we do not need to so worry about AI at this stage becoming smarter than us. We need to worry about making sure that the ways humans are using it are safe and carefully regulated.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with Eric Sullivan. He's a journalist and senior tech editor at Scientific American. We're talking to him about a collection of little stories and articles in Scientific American this month called Living in the Copilot Society, The Promise and Peril of Artificial Intelligence Everywhere. What I love about this collection of stories and articles, Eric, is that it's real people talking about how they've employed AI in their professional lives, but also really in their personal lives. And it really wakes you up to how it's being used out there and a lot of instances in which it's been sort of detrimental to especially the work environment, others it's been really beneficial. And so, as you say, you know, it all depends on the user. And I love what the teacher from Point Loma High School, Jen Roberts, says about it. You know, there are a few little blurbs in there that really caught my eye. And this one was, you know, it doesn't save me time. It lets me do more with the time that I have as a teacher. We know teachers' time is very precious. Also, a lot of people in the healthcare industry and medical professions. What were some of the most, you know, the stories that just stuck out for you in this collection?
So, I think that the stories, the vignettes of the folks, the real folks talking about how AI has been adapting their lives is quite interesting. The package looks at three arenas. Looks at care from a nursing and medicine perspective. It looks at trust and the rise of deepfakes. We talked to a deepfake expert from Berkeley named Hani Farid. He talks about best practices on how you and your family can protect yourselves against deepfakes. Then we have those first person as told to pieces that you mentioned. The nurse's story really stuck out to me. Because it really speaks to both the promises and the perils of AI. So promises, you know, the nursing community and the medical community at large, I think, has found that, you know, it does reduce documentation burden. It helps synthesize messy data. It allows for continuous monitoring. There's a new idea of ambient listening AI monitors. They're sort of always in that room with you listening so that the doctor doesn't need to take notes after. So I think that there are benefits that the medical community is seeing. However, the risks are real. I don't know if you watched the show The Pitt, but there was a recent incident on the show that actually is very close to what happens in this article, whereby the AI system flags a patient because it thinks that the doctor has said neurology when in fact they had said urology. And it causes this whole cascade of problems. I mean, that happens more and more all the time as AI gets folded in and as clinical communities figure out what works and what doesn't. And so we're in this period of great churn right now. And I think that that story really stuck out to me because it really encapsulated so much of what's happening.
Yeah. And so what it's really doing is asking us to be a filter in a way. Like, we have to be as knowledgeable about our, say, profession of nursing or whatever it is, as we are about the kinds of mechanisms that AI provides and these programs and flagging certain things and automating this and that. And we have to also know when to not trust it or when to question it. And that's a whole other skill in and of itself, isn't it?
Yes. And it's a skill that you don't get taught at school. It's something that we all have in our own way figured out as we have lived through this digital age. And again, it goes back to the same kind of safety principles and guidelines that you've put in place for yourself and your loved ones over the years to really make sure you are adequately familiar with the systems that that you should be engaged with. And it's not for everybody. Not everybody needs to know at this stage how to use ChatGPT or why Anthropic is important right now. You know, it's important to understand that these systems have become the background infrastructure in our lives, but it doesn't mean that necessarily you yourself need to engage. But for those who do decide to engage with it, it's important that you know best practices and have generally good principles that you would follow for any kind of digital usage. You want to have a healthy skepticism at all times.
I live in a family of artists, and we discuss AI quite a bit because there are a lot of ways that it can help make your ideas more cohesive or put these kind of funky inspirations into a format that is reachable for a lot of people, which is great. But at the same time, it feels like cheating. It feels like a shortcut because it is kind of, you're not doing all of the groundwork, which I think is what we give people kudos for, right? So Do you feel that some kind of mark or credit or indication that something has been AI involved is, number one, even realistic anymore? But also, would that help? Would it help for us to know something is 100% human created versus aided by AI?
10,000%, yes. And that speaks as much to my journalistic instinct for disclosure as it does anything else. But it's important that transparency be top of mind at all times for anybody creating any sort of content that uses AIs. So AI can be very helpful if for certain creative tasks, like you say. However, if there's any footprint of AI in the final product, and so say a piece of writing involved any degree of AI in the crafting of the prose, then absolute, or in the research stage, as you work through the story in, say, you know, sort of work on the structure of the story, et cetera. I think, you know, there is best journalistic practice that every newsroom is following now. And I'm speaking about journalism, of course, but then it also holds true for art as well. And any sort of creative practice, I think it's the disclosure is essential.
Okay. I do too. I'm going to get right on making some kind of logo that must be applied if something is a human, 100% human generated. I won't use an AI test for that. Some interpretations of the Luddite movement wasn't that they were only anti-technology, is that they were anti-exploitation. And so do we feel that some of the pushback with AI is similar, that it's not so much about the technology itself, it's about what it's going to do to humans?
I think that the concerns over what it's going to do to humans is the fundamentally most important question that we can ask ourselves here. And so I don't think at all that it is unreasonable to be concerned about that. That does not then translate to pretending like the technology doesn't exist or trying to put it in a box and tuck it away, because it's here and it's infiltrated our lives frankly, it's also not new. I mean, AI has been around and has been in the background of our lives for many years through filters, recommendation feeds, fraud detection, you know, but it's only in the last couple of years as the systems have gotten really good at language and the interface has gotten simple enough for anybody to use that it has become, you know, it's gotten to the stage where we can engage with it, that folks engage with it on a daily basis. And the notion that it will take away our jobs, I think you're seeing evidence of. Those are very real concerns. I think you're seeing concerning numbers in schools where the College Board is reporting that 84% of high schoolers are using generative AI for schoolwork. That's deeply concerning. And I think that it's absolutely an essential part of the conversation. However, it becomes then a question of how this technology can be safely and positively, you know, for the sake of humanity, used, not used for evil, instead of saying, well, we shouldn't engage with it at all. Because to me, that's sort of wishing for a past that doesn't longer exist.
Let's go into these deep fakes. You write an article within this collection of articles and vignettes called The Age of Impersonation. It's a conversation you're having with digital forensics pioneer Hani Farid. I don't know a lot about deepfakes. I've heard these crazy stories about parents getting calls in the middle of the night and it's their kid's voice on the phone saying that they need XYZ or they've been kidnapped or whatever it is. How widespread is that? And give us an example of a really surprising and scary deepfake that you know that you learned about.
So deepfakes are also nothing necessarily brand new. What a deepfake is it's synthetic media that convincingly imitates a real person's face or voice. And so, you know, you can use something called voice cloning, where you can, with just small snippets of a person's audio, then turn that into a bot that can speak in that person's voice, which can lead to the sort of phone calls from your kids asking, you know, for money. And so I think that, you know, the difference now is that with artificial intelligence being as accessible and as powerful as it's become, deepfakes are now cheap and fast and scalable, and impersonation has become one of the primary digital crimes that is on the rise. So, you know, the 2 a.m. call that you received from your childhood, voice cloning, I think is one of the scariest instances I've heard. And I've heard it also as sort of the grandmother receiving a call from her grandchild asking for money because they've run out, and just sort of say, could you wire me $500? And it's actually sort of a voice cloning, not the actual grandchild. I mean, that's scary, scary stuff. But deepfakes also, beyond financial crimes, can also involve the non-consensual intimate imagery that has torn not just, you know, young women's lives apart, but whole communities apart. There are stories happening all over where, you know, because of bullying, or, you know, all of a sudden a deepfake image of showing a nude of a teen that is not even real has spread around to every kid in the school before a single teacher has seen it. And I think that that's also the speed at which they that deepfakes can spread is the biggest concern, because by the time it goes up, the damage is already done. And so I think that it is a very real concern here.
At the same time AI is developing, are there safeguards against deepfakes that are developing to kind of protect ourselves from it?
So there are mechanisms in place for deepfakes to be taken down. And there is, as of recently, legislation passed by the federal government put in place that dictates the terms by which these companies need to take the material down. However, the time frame with which the legislation apportions a company to take that deepfake down is something like 48 hours. And so if a company has 48 hours to take a piece of content down after it goes up, or after they've been notified, I can't remember which one, that is 47 hours and 59 minutes too long from when that piece of content could have spread across the globe. And so the timing with which we can catch deepfakes, I think, is one of the biggest areas that cybersecurity is focusing on. And they have a long way to go, because the people who are creating these deepfakes are always pushing the technology forward and making them more and more convincing.
There are so many aspects that I would love to discuss with you. I'm afraid we don't have too much time left. What would be a good resource for people who want to keep up with articles like this? Scientific American is one place, but where else should they be reading, watching, paying attention to see what's happening and trying to keep up?
Like a media diet for AI information?
Yeah. Yeah. Or just a trusted resource that's not histrionic. It's curated.
Yeah, curated. Well, I have the sources that I go to and read all the time. And honestly, I think that is how I would answer the question, is just, you know, sort of the media outlets that I go to. Now, there are the tried and true. I mean, the daily reporting at the Wall Street Journal is phenomenal, and Reuters is phenomenal. Bloomberg is mind-blowing as well. And all three of those places cover the business side of artificial intelligence. But then also for the sort of the cultural impact, I think there are some digital outlets like 404 Media that are really doing an admirable job of covering this space in a way that is not only, you know, breaking new ground, but changing policy. And so 404 Media would definitely be high up on the list. And there are certain substacks that I read, like Casey Newton's Transformer, and, you know, several others that, you know, the trusted voices. The problem, I think, is if you just try to go online and try to read about AI, just like anything on the internet, you'll be overwhelmed with the information there. And so, you know, none of the names that I really said, except for maybe some of the newer institutions, are all that surprising. It's, you know, again, going to the trusted sources that we've known about for a long time and seeing how they're talking about this stuff.
Yeah. And curated wasn't quite the right word. Balanced was the word I think I was looking for more, because you can get a lot of curated information. It depends on who's curating it. As kind of a last parting thought for our listeners, do you have any kind of guiding advice for how to take care when using AI?
I think that it's like with any new technology, important to maintain that healthy skepticism every step of the way. And so never trust that what AI is telling you is factually accurate. In fact, these models, the large language models, often are trained to reinforce what you're asking for or looking for. And so you have to always doubt the validity of what it's saying and or question and prod and use your own best judgment at every step. And frankly, I think, yeah, take nothing that what it says at face value. Always do your research. I think that that's the best piece of advice you can have.
Question and prod. Yeah, I love that. Okay, well, Eric Sullivan is our guest. He's a senior desk editor for technology and engineering at Scientific American. And he's been talking to us about this whole feature in Scientific American's March issue just coming out. Really interesting, Eric. And thank you so much for joining us on The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much. This is great.